Welcome to the Biz Dad Podcast, where we dive into the melding of fathership and entrepreneurship with your host, the original Biz Dad himself, Adam Labar. Adam is a Christian, a former Air Force officer, a dad to three amazing kids, a coach, a real estate investor, and a business owner. On this podcast, he'll explore the unique journeys of amazing dads who are striving for greatness in both business and family. So, whether you're a dad who is an aspiring entrepreneur, a seasoned business owner, or simply a man striving to be a better dad, get ready as the Biz Dad brings you conversations to inspire, challenge, and equip you to be a better dad and entrepreneur. And now, here's Adam.
What is your favorite thing about your dad?
He is really, really smart.
And he says, bleh.
All right. What does your dad do for work?
Real estate.
Riviera Realty.
All right. What do you wish your dad would do more?
Play video games with us.
Yeah, what AJ said.
What is going on, everybody? Welcome to the Biz Dad Podcast. Today, I am excited to talk to Carlos Rivera. Really looking forward to this conversation. He and I are both at GoBundance. We've chatted multiple times. Some exciting conversations I'm sure we're going to have, talking about fatherhood and business and all the stuff. So all that said, Carlos, I'm going to pass it over to you. Give us a quick background on who you are. Tell us about your family and then tell us about your business.
Yeah, Adam. So yeah, happy to be here. Appreciate the time you're giving me. So a little bit about myself. I grew up in Miami, Florida, Cuban household. So my parents were both born in Havana, Cuba, in 1960, early 1960s. They emigrated over to the United States after the Cuban Revolution when communism came to Cuba. My grandparents, which are their parents, basically had to start a new life. So they had to find jobs. They had to build businesses from scratch. Whatever they could do to make ends meet is what they had to do. So I very much grew up in kind of like this immigrant, exile type mentality, lots of scarcity, lots of conservatism, you know, don't waste money, don't do too many risky things. And that sort of has shaped my approach to business. I tend to be a very, very conservative person. Very early on in my career, I actually studied engineering and I went to go work at Yahoo. I was a software engineer because, you know, growing up in an immigrant family, you're told to go to school, get a good degree, get a good job, work there for the rest of your life, get invest in your 401k and retire at 65 and collect Social Security for the rest of your life. So that's basically all you're taught. And, you know, very quickly going into the workforce, 2008, we had the financial crisis and had a big layoff at Yahoo, like they had at many other companies. And that was kind of a huge eye-opening experience. I myself did not get laid off because my theory was I was like the lowest paid employee at the time, you know, and I did a lot of work compared to other people. But I did see a lot of kind of these like veteran type people that have been around forever at this company just get fired like in one day, like these 20 year employees of this, what was an iconic internet company. And, you know, it was scary. I mean, it was a scary thought because I always thought that if I just worked really hard and did what I needed to do or did what I was told to do, that I would just have a job for the rest of my life. And that was not the case. I mean, your job is very much a fragile thing that you could lose at any minute, no matter what, no matter how good you are. So what I did was the cliche thing of read Rich Dad, Poor Dad, which was a book that my economics teacher in high school had recommended to us. But I, of course, you know, as a high school student, you're not going to read any of the books that your teachers recommend. But for some reason, that stuck in my head, and I picked it up one day at a Barnes & Noble, and I read it. I read the entire thing, and it sort of changed, you know, my entire mindset, like it does for most people. And that leads, obviously, to the rabbit hole that is all the other Robert Kiyosaki books and all the other business books and the real estate books, and that's how I discovered real estate. So it's 2009, the worst of the financial, like the worst days of the financial crisis. I live in Miami, Florida, which is one of the hardest hits markets in the United States when it came to that particular crisis or recession. And I get this crazy idea to buy a duplex. I'm engaged to my now wife. And of course, what do you do when you're engaged? You look for a house, you know, your dream home. But I got this crazy idea to buy a duplex, live on one side, rent out the other, and you not have to pay.
Smart thinking.
Pay a mortgage. Of course, it's 2009. So anybody who's invested in real estate is a loser, has lost their properties, is in foreclosure, bankruptcy, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a really negative, kind of bad perception of real estate investing. I was so clueless. I mean, I was 22 years old that I didn't even know there was a financial crisis going on. So I think that helped because the negativity, I think, was not like influencing me. So I went for it. I mean, properties were cheap back then. The only problem is that financing was like impossible to get. But we pulled it off. I had to convince my wife. She, when I said, let's buy a duplex, she imagined like us living in the hood, you know, some low income area in a duplex, you know. But we found a property in Pinecrest, which is a very affluent neighborhood that still had some pockets of multifamily. And we found this duplex that was very nice, and we bought it. We moved into it. And, you know, she agrees, and we both agree that was one of the best decisions we ever made was to buy that initial property. It really helped us save money because you're not paying mortgage, right? Like I would have had to pay a regular mortgage or rent if I were living in a house. But in this situation, I had a person next door who was giving me a check every month that was basically covering the majority of my mortgage payment. I think I was out of pocket like $300 a month or something like that, which is, you know, ridiculous.
Yeah.
So that led to us being able to save a lot of money. I kept working at Yahoo. She kept working at her job. I always had some sort of side hustle. I would like make websites for people on the side. I was always coming up with ways to like make extra money because I got this taste of passive income and I wanted more of it. Like I just wanted to save. I wanted to buy the next property and I wanted to buy the next property. And so whatever we could do to accelerate that, we did. So, I mean, I was always working, always coming up with ridiculous ways to make money. And we were able to buy our second duplex, thankfully, a couple of years later. It took a while to save up for it. And that snowball kept growing, and we just bought more properties over the course of 3-4 years until we had a nice little portfolio of properties. And that's when the market turned. I think it was like 2013, 14, where things just started getting really expensive again. And it was hard to find properties in Miami that would cash flow. Because I was big on cash flow. Because I entered the market in a time where people were purchasing not for cash flow, for appreciation, and then properties stopped appreciating, and then the crisis occurred. So I was very much ingrained with this, like, you need to have cash flow, positive cash flow, always, always, always. And that became very difficult in the Miami market to find. So one conversation led to another conversation, which led to another conversation. And long story short, I discovered the Kansas City, Missouri market. And I bought a house, a single family home there for $80,000 just to kind of try it out. Super cheap, really, you know, relatively easy to pull off. I financed it. So I put like $20,000 down or $15,000 down. And it worked out. It was a nice little rental. So I bought another one, Eventually I had this nice little portfolio of single family homes. And I was trading the duplexes that I owned in Miami had appreciated so much that I would sell one duplex and I could buy like five houses in Kansas City.
Yeah.
So the portfolio sort of snowballed until around the time where COVID hit, where then again things kind of stopped and prices got expensive. Multifamily just went crazy. And by then I had met my current partner in Kansas City. His name is Alfredo, and he and I put our heads together and we decided to start buying some bigger deals. And we pivoted into commercial. So today we own 6 buildings. They're a mix between office and retail, all in the Kansas City market. And it basically, you know, traded up and 1031'd into all these properties from my existing portfolio. Nice. And I'm sort of right now on the tail end of having sold all of my smaller properties, my single family homes. I have like 2 left that I have to sell this year. And the focus is going to be just on commercial. Moving forward, it's a big boys club. It's a much, you know, smarter, business than residential. It's very, very much data driven, and my engineer brain needs that. Like that's, I'm very non-emotional when it comes to making, investment decisions, and I'm a very much a numbers guy. So commercial is a numbers game, whereas residential tends to be a little bit more of an emotional, game because you're buying houses and they're worth what the house next door sold. You know, you're not able to really create value as much in the residential side than you are in the commercial world. That's pretty much my business in a nutshell. I don't know if you want to dive into anything more specific.
No, if you can, just tell me a little bit about your family as well, just so I know your family makeup and everybody knows kind of where you're coming from there.
Yeah, so my wife, the one that didn't want to buy the duplex and then decided that it was a good idea. We got married in 2010, moved into the duplex. We had our first son in 2013. His name is AJ. He's 10 years old today. And then in 2016, we had our other son. His name is Ignacio. He's 7 years old today. We have since moved out of that duplex and we sold it for like triple what we bought it for. And we bought a house in the same neighborhood in Pinecrest, and we currently live there today.
Awesome. Yeah, my wife and I got married in 2013, but we started having the kids in 2014. So you beat us by a year on that one. So when in 2010 we got married. Sorry, what when by chance? What month did you get married? Just curious.
It's June 12th of 2010.
All right, we were May 29th of 2010. So right before you.
Ooh,
very nice, very nice. My wife is also the daughter of a Cuban immigrant. So my mother-in-law fled Cuba when she was like 17. And then they had to go to Spain first, hung out in Spain. And that's where my mother-in-law met my father-in-law before they came over here. So just a small bit of background there. But awesome. So what was your wife's name?
Her name is Isabel. Everybody calls her Isa. I-S-A. Isa.
Isa. That's my niece. We call her Isa. So Isabella.
There you go.
But
good name.
Isa. Very good. All right. I like it. Well, I really love the background. I obviously being a real estate guy as well. I went straight to multifamily instead of doing any single family houses. My first apartment building or my first investment property was a 62-unit apartment building. And the reason that I liked that is because my engineer type of brain thought the same thing. Like data was king. It didn't necessarily matter what the apartment building next door sold for. It did matter what it rented for, which is the same thing in commercial. It matters what something rents for per square foot. But it didn't matter what it sold for. It matters what I can make the NOI be. So
exactly.
I've been very interested in larger commercial properties and strip malls and that type of stuff. So maybe after this podcast, you and I can chat about that a little bit.
I
really want to learn a little bit more about that and dig in. But tell me a little bit about more about, I mean, I kind of got a good idea, of some of the conservative upbringing that you had as far as, some of that scarcity mindset and stuff, but tell me a little bit more about your dad, kind of what it was like growing up under him. And then maybe even your dad's dad, if you know any stories about that or kind of how your dad grew up.
Oh yeah. So we can actually start with my dad's dad's dad, my great grandfather. He was very much an entrepreneur. He was a Spaniard from Barcelona. He was Catalan. My grandfather was also born in Barcelona, and so my great grandfather was an entrepreneur. He started a rum company back then. You know, in the early 1900s, everybody in Spain would go to Cuba to make their wealth. So he went. He moved to Cuba and he opened a rum company that was very successful, and then sold it and retired at the age of 29 back to Barcelona. And that's where he got married, started having kids, and there he became a real estate developer. You know, he's a guy with money, so he's investing, he's doing different things, and he's an entrepreneur. Entrepreneurs can never stop working. He built a building in Barcelona where they lived on one of the floors, and then he would rent out the rest of the building. And that building still stands today. I've visited it multiple times when I go. And it's funny, there's on the gate, typical Spaniard, he has to put his mark on the building. On the gate, it says his initials, J.R., Jose Rovira, on like this iron gate. It's still there. I take a picture of it every time I go. But he's an entrepreneur. You know, he moved back to Barcelona. And then in 1934, I think, or 1936, I believe, there's the Spanish Civil War. So they have to flee Spain. Fascism takes over. And they go back to Cuba. So he goes back to Cuba, again, entrepreneur. So he opens a bunch of different businesses. He gets involved in the rum company again. He opened a movie theater, which is where my grandfather worked. And then in 1960, you know, the revolution comes and they have to flee. They basically have to leave everything behind. I actually went to Cuba a couple years ago and I visited the theater, the movie theater he owned. It's completely abandoned and it's pretty sad.
Of course. Yeah.
So they come to Miami, and my grandfather actually did not get the entrepreneur bug. He was an electrical engineer, studied at Georgia Tech, and then worked at the theater in Havana after he graduated. Never practiced as an engineer. And when he came to Miami, he actually had a real hard time finding work because they were going to make him like retake a whole bunch of like classes and stuff, yeah, since he hadn't practiced as an engineer. And imagine you've got three kids, you're living in a one bedroom apartment, you don't really speak the language that well. And, you know, there's a sense of urgency. So he really didn't have time to go back to school. So he had to find work, and he ended up working at a jewelry store at Mayer's, which is a really well-known jewelry store here in Miami, until he retired. But my dad, he did get the entrepreneur bug. He started a business. He used to work at a bank, and he told me that the day he realized he needed to start his own business was a day that he spent his entire day in meetings. And in banks, they would just sit around having meetings all day, but then they would never do any work. It was just like meeting after meeting, and then nobody would ever do anything. And he vowed to never have a meeting again after he started his own business. So he launched a marble company, basically a stone manufacturing company. So basically they do like countertops and flooring and stuff of granite and quartz. And his business actually has done well for us. I mean, he has big contracts with the cruise lines. So he does all of like the stonework on the Carnival cruises and the Royal Caribbean cruises. And those ships, nice, they go through like major beatings on the ocean. So all of the stone and the floors and stuff are like constantly breaking. So every couple of years, they have to take the ships out of the rotation and completely renovate them. So it's basically never ending work because they have so many ships that are constantly being taken out. Awesome. It's done well. I mean, he basically has relied very heavily on the cruise lines. And we grew up very much a middle class family. We didn't have that much wealth, but we always had money because my dad had a good business and we never had a shortage of things. We always had food. We always went on vacations. We always, you know, we went to private schools. We didn't grow up rich, like a very wealthy, you know, lavish family, but you know, it was enough. And I also got sort of the entrepreneur bug. I have a hard time working for other people. I tend to get frustrated very quickly, and then I become very defiant and annoying and, you know, not a good employee. So that's sort of where my, you know, where the entrepreneur bug kind of came from, is through my dad. But yeah, I mean, that's pretty much in a nutshell.
Awesome. Yeah, I really like that a lot. You could tell that bug has been kind of passed down, you know, whether intentionally or unintentionally. It's just kind of the way it works out, the way it's been passed down. But I really like the background story. And I mean, boy, having the bounce back and forth between Spain, Cuba, back to Spain, back to Cuba.
Dude, exiled to twice.
Goodness.
Exiled twice. He had to leave Spain and then had to Cuba and then have to leave Cuba to the United States. Can you believe that? Yeah. In one lifetime. It's incredible.
Golly. That's... but builds a lot of resilience, that's for sure. But and a lot of, I would imagine, lack of trust in the government. But I mean, if it were me, I would have a whole lot of lack of trust in any government system whatsoever. Yeah. But awesome. That was a really good background. I appreciate that. So I want to kind of go into, you know, you started off in Yahoo. How did the transition go? I don't think we really touched that. I mean, you talked about jumping into buying the duplex, which is probably like where you got that taste. How did you end up leaving Yahoo to start to do this stuff full time?
Yeah, I mean, it was hard. I had a lot of fear of giving up the paycheck.
Yeah.
It took me 9 years. I started working there in 2008 and I didn't leave until 2016 when my second son was born. I worked, for lack of a better term, my ass off. I mean, I was always working. either at work or on whatever side hustle or trying to buy real estate. I would work on my side hustles while at work at Yahoo. And I'm a really hard worker. I could juggle multiple things.
Yeah.
And in 2016, it got to a point where, and my second son was about to be born. I had taken this like 8-week paternity leave that, you know, the tech companies give. And I remember I had already bought a whole bunch of houses in Kansas City, and I had enough income where it just like I was just not in a position where I needed money anymore. And I had become so exhausted by, it was just, that company went through so much drama. I mean, they got bought out eventually by Verizon, and then Verizon sold them to a private equity firm. This is all this crap, you know, and the employees always take the brunt of that instability.
Yeah.
So I think by 2016, there was they were about to get bought out by Verizon. And then there was just so much negativity around the office and more layoffs. And it was always a layoff or like a reorganization or like, now you have a new boss because we're changing this and we're changing that. And it was just like, I was over it and just exhausted. It had been 9 years and I already had real estate income. So I took the plunge and just wrote out the paternity leave and I didn't come back after.
Awesome. That's probably a very good feeling. When I was in the military, there was a buddy of mine that I was chatting with. He had, at that time, 20 houses completely paid off that were bringing him in income. And he was kind of like, you know, I'm in a really good position. He's like, I want to stay in. I want to keep serving, but, you know, I don't have to. Like, if they give me an assignment I don't want, then I get to jump ship, you know. And that was, you know, for you, if you're dealing with something you don't want, it's, you know, you're setting yourself up for success. You know, you don't have to quit your job to do this stuff full time, but if you do this stuff and it's bringing you in the income, then, I mean, you're only setting yourself up for a more solid and more favorable future for you. So it was well done on your part. So
in retrospect, I probably... shortly after I left was when the Verizon deal closed, and then there was a huge layoff. And I was thinking later, like, I probably could have just stayed a couple of extra months and then taken like a severance. But like, I always had this thing about being laid off. Like, I didn't want to be a person who got fired from a job. So I had kind of like this like pride of like, I left on my own terms versus being fired like every other employee who leaves that company ends up leaving. So sorry to interrupt.
Yeah. No, you're good. You're good. And I mean, that sense of drive and pride is probably one of the reasons that helps you become a successful entrepreneur as well. Right. Is because you're like, no, I'm not going to let this fail. I'm going to make this work.
Right.
I'm going to make this happen on my terms. Like, I'm going to make this happen and, you know, not leaving it up to somebody else to make it happen. So, So I left the military after having kids as well. Shortly after our second kid was born, I was like, I can't keep doing what I'm doing. Like, it was sucking my soul from my body on a daily basis. And I was like, I don't get to spend time with my kids. I don't get to do any of this stuff. So was it more, you know, I'm assuming that based off the way you described it, it was a lot to do with the kids and why you left. I mean, you obviously set yourself up well. I mean, I had a couple of apartment buildings. You had quite a few houses. And it was like, okay, well, we're set up well. Why the heck would we keep dealing with this? Like, what level of it was, I just want to be done with this? And what level of it was like, I really just want to be around my kids a little bit more?
My kids were still very young. Like, now they're 10 and 7. Now is when I really want to spend time with them because they're actually fun.
Yeah.
When they're small babies, it's a lot of hard work. So you're not really thinking about, oh, I need to spend time with them. You're really sort of like in like the survival mode of, I need to keep them alive and make sure they don't die. So I don't think it really crossed my mind that I need to spend time with my kids. I always knew that it was important to spend time with my kids, and I always made time for it. I think that even if I had the job, I probably would. I mean, it's a tech company, so they're flexible and, you know, you can work from home and stuff like that. So I don't think I really had like the, oh, I'm in prison type mindset with the job.
Yeah.
But what was really weighing down on me there was just the incompetence and the mediocrity that I was surrounded with all day long. That wore me down. Like, just employees who are just lame ducks and sitting around because there's going to be a buyout and complaining, and it was just not a good environment. So I think that's kind of what, at the end of the day, made me make the decision. It just got so toxic that it was just not worth you know, the 60 grand a year or whatever it is I was making, or 80 grand a year. That was like, it just was so soul sucking from that perspective that that's kind of what pushed me out. And my kids were still relatively young. So
how many employees do you have? Oh, sorry,
how many employees do I have?
No, go ahead with what you're saying now, with what you're working on. I'll ask a question.
I think if it were to happen now, there'd be a much more bigger focus on, I need to spend time with my kids, because if I'm surrounded by toxicity at work, I'm going to bring it home with me.
Yeah.
And then that's what my kids are going to see. And then that's what they're going to learn. So I think that's probably what would have driven my having left if I were to have waited this long. But
yeah, my oldest was, I think, when did I get out? I think he was six or seven when I left. I knew when he was probably three that I needed to make a change, because I was traveling all the time and he came running up to me once when I was taking the trash out. Daddy, 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 don't leave again. And he's crying his eyes out. And I was like, ah, crap. You know, like, I was just taking the trash out, but I had traveled so much. I had said goodbye to him so many times already. And he's only three. Like, I mean, his first birthday I spent on a Zoom call, or on a FaceTime call from Africa, you know? And so I'm like watching him do a smash cake from on a FaceTime call while I'm, you know, deployed to Africa. And I was like, I can't, you know, at that point, I had enjoyed what I was doing. And I was like, that's okay. I know this is just one of the sacrifices that I have to make. But the more sacrifices that I kept making, the more I was like, no, I don't have to make the sacrifice. I could choose something else. But
and the longer you wait, the more potential regret you're going to have, right? Like, you missed so many milestones, especially those early years that are so important for the kids. So
That's tough. And I, you know, my second kiddo, I was like, I don't want to have another, like, my second kid's first birthday be while I'm deployed some random place, some, you know, armpit of the world. You know, I've been to enough armpits. I don't need to go to any more armpits. If I'm going to travel, I want it to be on my own terms, right? But so how many employees do you have now, or roughly?
Yeah, okay. So we're vertically integrated. So I have three companies. I have RG Capital Partners, which is the Kansas City investment company. I have Rovira Capital, which is the company that we use to buy our personal rentals and stuff, just my wife and I. And then Rovira Property Management is the property management company that then manages all of the units that we own in those two companies. Okay. We don't have any employees, and obviously in the holding companies, the employees are all in the property management company. We have two employees in Kansas City. We have one here in Miami, and then my wife and I run the day-to-day. You know, we're not really employees, we're just owners.
Yeah.
We got three actual like full-time employees, and it's actually been enough. You know, we make a really good, we're really scrappy. We can do a lot with very little. And it took me really long to hire that first person. Like, I held out. And then the second person was like a very calculated, because it's a big expense and a big responsibility to have payroll. So I think we've done a relatively good job of growing very slow, very methodically, not without overhiring and, you know, being in over our heads.
So how much of the, you know, you read a bunch of different books on managing people and like making sure you have right person, right seat, if you're like talking EOS type stuff or various different things. And I would imagine coming from your position, I'm just trying to understand your thought process behind or how you're kind of managing employees now, coming from a spot where, you know, the way you said incompetence and mediocrity were kind of the norm and that kind of drove you crazy. How does that affect the way you're managing your businesses and employees now? Like, what are your expectations and kind of how do you make sure that you're hiring people that aren't going to be incompetent and mediocre?
Yeah, well, I guess it's a twofold question. It's how do we find the right people and how do we manage them once they're in the seat?
Yes. Yeah.
Well, I always hire a recruiter. I pay money to have somebody do the interviewing for me because I am horrible at hiring. I will hire the first person that I interview because I feel bad, you know, like out of pity. Oh, I'm going to make it work. And then I end up regretting it later. And my first assistant, I hired that way. I ended up having to get rid of him before a year. So I told myself, I'm never not going to hire a recruiter. It cost me $5,000 up front. And I had to stomach that, just pay the money. It is so worth it. I mean, they go through hundreds of resumes. They interview people on Zoom. Like, idiots, like such idiots that they interview and they weed them all out. I don't have to even look at them. They send me videos of the Zoom interviews. I pick and choose the ones that I like. So like, I don't have like that guilt. I can just like discard of people that I've never met, and it's no guilt because they have to do it. Yeah. Like they have to tell the person, no, you didn't get the job. I don't have to be the one to tell the person that they didn't get the job. So it makes it really easy for me. And then they make them do like these personality assessments. Like it's very data oriented as well. And like a very thorough, it's like a 3-step interview process. So if a person goes through this like rigorous 3-step process, and the second step, they have to fill out this huge like test. Like it's like an hour and a half evaluation. Like if they're taking the time to get through all of that, like a lot of people drop off on the second step. They just don't even fill out the thing. And it's easy. Okay, fine. We're not hiring that person. If they get through that and they get through the 3 interviews, then you have a relatively high chance that they're going to be a good quality person. So we put a lot of emphasis up front on the hiring. And then once they're in, we have to just create systems. I mean, that goes back to my engineering background. It's, you know, it's a lot of logic. If then this, if that. I mean, we have programs like monday.com, which is a task management system. And so it's very transparent what everybody's working on. We have a weekly meeting where we go through the whole list of tasks and we just keep everybody accountable. And you get to learn like what certain employees are stronger at and what they're weaker at. And you can help them kind of, you can sort of leverage what they're really good at and then help them learn in other ways where they're weaker. I mean, it's hiring, very rigorous hiring up front. Like don't get lazy on the hiring side. And then this accountability and systems and lots of communication. 99.9% of problems can just be avoided if people just communicated effectively. And
I've seen a lot of that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome. So these recruiters, I'm intrigued. I'm the one who tends to do a lot of the interviews for hiring in our companies. But when the recruiter is going through, how do they kind of process this? Or what is it that, what do you give them so that you get the right output back? Let's start there.
Yeah, so I tell them what I want to hire. So in my case, usually property manager. And they'll have like templates of property manager job postings, and they'll send it to me, and then we edit it and we add and remove what we want. And then they'll use that and they'll post that on like LinkedIn and Indeed and all the different job postings. And then as the resumes come in, they'll filter them out and then they'll do interviews or they'll weed out the people they don't like, and then they'll set up interviews with the ones that they do like, and then whoever does show up to the interview, they'll record the interview on Zoom. And then every Friday they send you an email with like 3 or 4 of like the top candidates that they thought would fit. We watch all the videos. A lot of times, like the first 2 minutes, you're like, nope, this person sucks, and you just move on. If I like the person, then I'll respond to the recruiter and tell them, okay, yes, move them to the second phase. And then the second phase is like this hour and a half of like personality tests that they have to take. And then there's a second interview where he goes over one by one every question, and the person has a chance to answer. Like the thing will spit out like an evaluation of this is the way you are. This is your personality based on how you answered. And then it'll go on to every question, and the person will have a chance to agree or disagree with the evaluation and then just give their justification. And you sit in this interview silently. I don't say anything. It's a Zoom call. And the recruiter does all the work. You just sit
and
there.
They know you're there, though?
They know you're there, yeah. And then at the end, I'm allowed to ask just, you know, free-form questions, which I usually do. And then if they get past that, then we bring them in for an in-person interview. And it's interesting. A lot of times, the people on Zoom look really good, and they present themselves really good. And then when they show up to the office, there's like a weird energy, or like they're different. Like all of a sudden they show up different and they're not as good. So it's crazy how like even in person, like if you do this kind of methodically, you can weed out people even at the final step. So yeah, it works. It takes a while. It takes several months for you to get the person. So you can't be in a hurry. You have to be patient.
That was
a lot
my
of
next
times
question,
the first round of interviews that they send are horrible. Like there's a little bit of tweaking like you'll respond saying, I don't like this person because of this, this, and this. And you know, with your feedback, they can sort of tailor the next few interviews that they send over.
Yeah. When I was hiring my personal assistant, it was an outsourced VA out of the Philippines type of thing. And like the amount of nonsense you get in right away anyways is like the amount of like applications that clearly haven't read what you're actually looking for. Like they just shotgun out things all the time. So I started using a lot of different tricks that I had read online, like asking him to put certain things in and like do certain bits of homework. Patrick Bet David, I don't know if you know who he is, but he's down out of Boca, but he's a big entrepreneurial type of guy, has a great podcast. And but anyways, he talks about one of the things that on his second layer of an interview is having the person go and read a book and then write kind of a book report on it and bring it back to the second interview. Like, but one of the things in his company is they have a book of the month. Everybody in the company has to read this book every month, like every, or is it quarter or month? I don't remember. But he's like, look, if you're not willing to read a book for the job, then you're not going to be willing to do some of the other stuff I'm going to ask you to do. So like the job's going to require a lot of stuff and you're going to be required to read a book when you come in here. So I might as well make sure you know that it's a requirement before you even get the job, you know? And so he's like, yeah, if you don't read the book or you don't show up in the book report, then you're automatically not going to be included. I was, you know, and it's those hurdles that really help, like you were saying, you know, having that three-step process, those hurdles help make sure that you're weeding out the folks who are just looking to get a paycheck and be that mediocre person that you were talking about before and not the person who's driving forward. So what are your goals for growth right now as you're moving through? Obviously you're looking to get rid of your last couple single family houses. You're only focused on commercial stuff right now. What are your goals for growth and what's your plan to kind of get those goals accomplished?
Yeah. So I set my goal to get to 400 units. We're at about 200 today. So basically double by the end of the year. And that could be a combination of, because we do third-party management as well, that could be a combination of other clients that we manage for and then stuff that we've acquired. Obviously, I prefer that most of it be stuff that we've acquired.
Yeah.
But that's kind of the number I threw out into the universe to see, you know, what sticks or what comes back. And I'd like to buy some more commercial properties this year. It's getting kind of tough with interest rates, and there's, you know, kind of relative stalemate in the market. There's not a lot of supply coming out, especially in the retail side. And I've started to look more in Miami and South Florida area to see if I can buy some stuff down here. I think now there's kind of opportunity while there's stalemate to get some creative deals done down here, where otherwise you wouldn't be able to because there's just so much money being thrown around. But yeah, that's kind of what I'm looking for. So I do a lot of, you know, like LoopNet trolling to see what properties I can find, and I'll call brokers because a lot of times brokers will have, especially commercial brokers, they'll have a lot of off-market stuff that they don't post, but then they'll use the LoopNet listing to get people to call them, right? So they'll be like, oh no, that property is, but I have this one. So I try to call the brokers to just kind of start knowing them and getting to know who they are, because I think now having broker relationships might be more important than ever, because they're going to have to start catering more towards buyers, whereas before things were just flying off the shelves, so they could just post any listing and it would sell immediately. I think brokers now are getting into a position where they're having to nurture buyers a little bit more. I'm getting a lot of callbacks from brokers where before I wouldn't even get them to answer an email. So I think we're in an interesting position where, as a buyer, if you focus on making broker connections and looking for some off-market deals, you might be able to. And if you can do creative stuff like seller financing and, you know, lease options and stuff like that, get more sophisticated, which in the commercial side is more common to see that sort of stuff.
Yep.
I think we'll be well positioned. So, you know, I can't control the market, but I can control how much time I spend searching for deals and how many phone calls I make. So I'll just keep doing that until something sticks.
Awesome. Yeah, it's been a bear. Like me being in multifamily, it's been such, like you said, at the beginning of COVID, like the prices started going nuts. It made great for me to be able to sell. Some of them I think I sold a little too early, you know, because it was like, especially when you have investors, you're like, I'm going to sell now because it makes sense for my investors. And then you realize, boy, if I'd have waited a year, I could have made them even more money, you know. But it's, you know, you don't know where the top is until you're on the way down. So, you know, but Question for you on like the kids side of the house. Your kids are getting to an age where they, 10 and 7, where they kind of understand a little bit more of what maybe daddy does, what mom and dad do. Kind of how do you have conversations with them about what you do, like when you go to the office and, looking at properties and all that type of stuff? What kind of conversations do you guys have with them?
Yeah. So, they know we're in real estate. They know what we do. They know that we buy buildings. We simplify it. We buy buildings. That and we fix them and we make them nice and we rent them to people and we get money from the rent. My older son AJ, he's very much a numbers kid. He's good at math. He's very smart, like very academic smart. My second son Ignacio is more of like a creative type. He's more high level. He doesn't focus too heavily on the details, so they're very different in terms of their kind of learning style and what their interests are. So my older son, AJ, has had more exposure to the business side just because he's older and it's easier to explain things to him. He's more educated because he's had more math education. He can read. Ignacio's still learning how to read. So we're sort of still in the basics with him. With AJ, I brought him into the office before to like show him deals that I'm working on. I've shown him like underwriting spreadsheets to explain to him how, the math. He's a numbers kid, so he likes seeing numbers. So I've explained to him how to underwrite a shopping center as an example. I explained to him what a cap rate was. Does he remember what it is? I don't know, but we'll keep exposing him to that sort of stuff. I never got any sort of financial education as a kid. No one never told me what a mortgage was. I thought that a bank was a place where you put your money, not a place where you can borrow money. No one ever explained any of that to me. So we have explained to him the concept of debt and leverage and interest and, and that sort of, information that you don't really get. So we feel like, the more we expose him to it, the better. I think I want to take him to Kansas City with me this year so he can see some of the buildings that we've bought.
Yeah.
Because right now it's like I have pictures in the office and he sees them, but it's not real. So I think I want to kind of expose them a little bit more to the business side, because I think AJ will do really well in like a very technical, like architecture or something like that. He loves Legos and building. He's obsessed with Legos and building things and very detail, very detail oriented. So I think he'll do well in like a technical career, whether it's engineering or architecture or something.
Yeah.
And that works That's well awesome. In real estate, because if we get into development and stuff and have a son who's an architect, it jives well with our business. So.
You won't have to hire, you'll just create the employee that you're looking for. Yes.
Yeah. And that's sort of a dream that I have, is to be able to build a business that can employ my family. I would love to have a big enough company where like my sons can do whatever they want from a career perspective, but like if they fail and they need a job, they could just come back and work for the family business. I kind of want that. I feel like that would be a really good thing to have. So whatever I can create now and whatever seeds I can plant now to kind of help that in the future, would be very helpful.
I like that a lot. The management company side of the house, do you manage, obviously your properties in Kansas City, but do you also manage properties there in Miami?
Yeah, we're about half and half. Miami's okay. Mostly third party stuff because I've sold everything I own here.
Okay. Yeah.
And then Kansas, I would say probably actually Kansas City is probably like 60% of the portfolio, and then 40% of stuff here in Miami that we manage for other people.
Are they able to kind of go with you on trips to those properties there in Miami as well?
We haven't yet, because I'd rather they be in school. But on days that they're off. I know. But on days that they're off, I'll bring them to the office for a couple of hours. And the only issue is that I don't really go that much to the properties I have here. I have an assistant here who is the kind of the boots on the ground. Yeah. So I don't really visit buildings that often anymore here in Miami, which is part of the reason why I would like to start investing a little bit more here. Because I spend most of my day in front of a computer, directing people. And I kind of have this thirst or this hunger for just being hands-on. So if I could buy one or two buildings this year in South Florida, I think it would be great. And then I can expose the kids even more, because we can take them, before we start the work and show them where our plans are and that sort of stuff.
For sure. I like it. So I started homeschooling this year. And one of the reasons was because I wanted to bring the kids random places when I travel. Like I was talking about before, I traveled enough for the military where I couldn't bring them places, or certainly wouldn't even if I could have brought them. But now it's like, man, I went to San Antonio for, you know, something. I'm going up to Vermont here in a couple of weeks for the GoBundance trip, dragging the kids with me. Today they're on a homeschool trip to some dinosaur land, something that's semi close to me. So I keep wanting to buy something local to me here in Tampa, like, because I want to do the same thing. I want to take them on tours of the properties and show them what we're buying and show them what we're looking at. But golly, it's really hard to find a deal that actually makes sense to buy, let alone bring my kids to.
So, it's hard.
It's like, God, Florida's just been getting just destroyed with the, I mean, it's a positive thing ultimately, but it's just hard when you're looking for cash flow to buy something here in Florida, because it's just,
let me tell you, man, Miami is on fire. And there's,
oh yeah, it's nuts.
Like I'm in the street and there's so much traffic and every shopping center is full. And you hear all this like negative news about like San Francisco and all these cities where there's like just homeless people and like economies are just crashing, and I don't see that at all in Miami.
Certainly not there in Miami.
Booming here. Yeah.
It's even when I was in Austin, like when I was there for a little while for a golf trip, like it was a lot of homeless. So it's like, what in the world? Like, but there, it just, you don't really see it here at all. There's still obviously you're gonna see some here and there, but it's not like San Francisco's rough. Like some of the videos I see of just like right in front of nice buildings. Like there's no way I would want to buy a commercial building where there's already an encampment sitting in front of it. Even if it, like, it's nuts. Absolutely crazy. But you know, not to get too political, but when you look at what's going on, you know, you can't.
Yeah, well, it seems like it's all these very far left progressive places. Like I hear Seattle is also bad with, and Denver. Portland. So, you know, I mean, take the hint, people. Like,
stop. Math adds up. Don't do that. Okay. Yeah. Yes. But you know, I think part of that also, you and I have very logical brains. I tend to be super unemotional about things. excuse me. So we forgot to mention at the front, you and I both slept like garbage, very sick. tissues.
We're powering through. That's what we do.
Powering through to make sure this happens, right? But
would you like a tissue? I can hand it to you.
Please hand it right through the camera. Thank you very much. Yes. Man, it's been a rough morning already. I don't remember where I was going with this. Anyways, doesn't really
about
matter. So
the homeless people and math adds up. I'm very unemotional.
Oh yes, very unemotional. Thank you. Yeah, you were listening. I'm proud. Yeah. Thanks, Carlos. But I tend to be super unemotional about a lot of stuff. So I look at very logical things, and I'm like, okay, well, logically, that thing is not working, so I'm not going to do that again. Where the emotional brain can tell you, well, it's just because we're not doing it this way. You know, like we keep talking about, oh, well, it's because we haven't tried the correct communism here in America, or the correct communism hasn't been tried. Like, there is no such thing as the correct communism. Like, it just baffles my mind. Like, logically, it doesn't work. It just doesn't work.
Well, have you ever heard that saying that the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result?
Yeah.
That's what it is. I mean,
what do you know? That's what we're doing.
Not that hard to be fiscally conservative and business friendly and not drive people away.
Apparently it is that hard. But Florida, I think, is doing a very good job. Miami, especially. Miami's been crushing it. The mayor down there has been really doing a great job of attracting the right people.
Yeah, he's a good guy. Yeah, Francis.
I mean, I don't know.
He's a good dude. Miami's always been. My wife actually knows his wife. I think they went to school together. He always mentions that. Miami's always been kind of a hot spot, and especially for like foreign investment.
Yeah.
So even before the rush that COVID, that the post-COVID economy created, Miami's always been kind of a hot market, just because it has such a heavy Latin American presence that every time there's like a Latin American country that's collapsing, all the wealth somehow ends up in Miami, you know?
So we
have
as well as the crazy drivers from those countries.
Yeah, exactly.
That makes a lot of sense. That makes a ton of sense. And I think that, you know, it's being attracted a lot more, even US-based businesses now, like literally leaving New York City to go to Miami, which makes tons of sense,
yeah.
Honestly.
Restaurants. Like, the restaurant scene here is awesome. Like, there's so many, new and really good restaurants that have just opened up in the past few years. And they say it's because the restaurants in New York were closed during COVID, yeah. And they weren't allowed to reopen. So everybody's moved over to Miami. We were open the whole time. So,
which I'm not opposed to
restaurants out of it.
Yeah, there you go. And every time I go to Miami, though, it's just so packed. I just struggle. I'm like trying to drive through, and I'm like, this is insane. Yeah. I don't know.
It's a big city. I mean, it's just a big city.
Oh, it certainly is.
Comes with that.
Yeah. You know, I'm curious on a personal perspective. So, like, when I was a very paycheck to paycheck guy for a long time, had no idea, like, you know, to your point, never learned about a mortgage. A bank, again, was just a place that you put your money so that when I wrote a check, they knew where to pull the money from. You know, that's it. Like, I didn't know anything.
You didn't know what a savings account was. Remember that story?
I did not know what a savings account was. Yes. So marrying Raquel, she's being, again, her mom being Cuban, her grandma being Cuban, massive influence on her and the way she thinks, the two of those ladies. So saved every bit of her money. Very, like, she would be making an extra like $150 a day in per diem in like Colombia when she was down in Bogota. And she would still be making peanut butter and jelly sandwiches in her hotel room. She's at the JW Marriott on like the 15th floor of the JW in Bogota making peanut butter and jelly. Because she didn't want to go and spend any of the money somewhere else. And when we got married, it was like such a stark difference between how we looked at money and like what was our thought process behind it. And it sounded like you had a little bit of that, it still do, some of that conservatism in the way you're handling your finances. I'm trying to get better at that as years go on. I've gotten a lot better at it, understanding, you know, the power of saving money and investing money, obviously. What was it like for you and your wife? Like, what kind of conversations did you guys have around money before you got married and then as you guys have grown up and in building businesses together?
Yeah, well, thankfully, my wife is a bigger cheapskate than I am.
Ooh, very nice. Good.
She grew up also in a Cuban household, you know, very much conservative with money. So we've always, thank God, we've always been on the same page with regard to finance. It's not the quintessential, oh, my wife spends all my money thing, right? Yeah. She spends less money than I do. I don't think we ever had any issues. We always were on the same page. And once we had the duplex and we realized the power of the income, the passive income, we were very committed. So, I mean, I remember we had the spreadsheet where we would put all of our income and then every single bill we paid and then whatever was left over. We would transfer that out of our checking account and put it into a savings account, which was going to be used to buy real estate. And we would leave 1 cent in the checking account every month. And then our paychecks would hit again. And then we'd pay our bills. And it was like this never ending, you know, saving cycle. So we've always been very good at that. I actually would like to try to get that scarcity mindset out of me a little bit because I still, like, I remember the other day I was taking a shower and I like went like this to get the soap, the shampoo, and it was running out. And I got like this anxiety that the soap was running out and I didn't want to grab there was another one in the cabinet. Like I didn't want to waste the new one. I kept squeezing to get every last molecule of shampoo out of that bottle to not waste it. Like that was just like an innate thing that happened in me. And I remember feeling anxious over it. I'm like, what is this? Like, just throw away the damn bottle, grab another. So like little things like that are still kind of ingrained in my mind, like to not waste, to not create waste and to like use up every little bit of whatever you have before you spend money again. Still have that. And my wife is worse than me on that. Like I remember one time our vacuum broke and we had to buy a new vacuum. The house needed to be vacuumed. And it was like going to be like $300 to buy a vacuum. And she was like texting me like, oh, it's going to be $300. Should I buy it? I'm like, what? Why are you asking permission to buy a vacuum? We need the vacuum. Just buy it. Yes. We have money. Like, so it was like the second guessing of buying something you need. Right.
Yeah.
So we're trying to get a little bit better at it without it becoming out of hand or we're just spending everything. Yeah.
My wife does that same thing. She'll send me a message like, do you mind if I pay for lunch today with one of my coworkers? I'm like, it's $20. Go pay for lunch. It's okay. But at the same point, like I have still once in a while go off the other end, you know, is I'll pay for a family of 10. Like we're all out and I'm like, I'm just going to pay for everybody's. And it's like, okay, well, you don't always have to do that either. Right. For me, I love being able to do that. I love being able to break bed with people and pay for their meal. For her, it comes from a scarcity mindset as well, you know? So it is a lot of balance, and I'm happy that we're able to balance each other out, and I'm happy that you're working on at least looking at that part. Because like you mentioned the shampoo thing, and I remember there was times where I'd walk in and my wife would have the old shampoo bottle tipped upside down over the new shampoo bottle
so that it would drain it down.
You knew that, like shake it up a little bit, pour it over so it would go in. I'm like,
another thing is the paper towels. Like I'll grab a paper towel to dry my hands, and then I'll go and clean the counter with it. And wipe a little bit of the floor to make sure before I throw it away, to make sure I've used it enough, you know? And I remember my grandparents used to hang the wet paper towel to dry so that it could be reused. Like I always remember there was paper towels hanging like on their sink to dry. That's where I got that from, so that they wouldn't have to keep wasting paper towels.
Yeah, that's funny. It really does, you know. It's one of the reasons, and I told you before we started, it's one of the reasons I like to ask about your dad's dad, because it really helps us kind of understand where we get our frame of reference, where our wireframe for how we live our life comes from. And some of the silly things that we do, if we can realize where they come from, why we're doing what we're doing, that's a start of being able to change it, right?
Yeah.
Or maybe we don't want to change it, right? Maybe it's still, no, I really love this part of why I'm doing what I'm doing, and I want to feed into that. And sometimes it's, no, I really want to run away from that, you know? I wanted to run away from living paycheck to paycheck because I saw that there was another way until somebody changed my thought process, until I got married. And I was like, boy, I didn't know there was another way to live this life. Like I just thought this is what you did. Because again, same as you, I was told, hey, if you go to the military, you get paid every 2 weeks, you get a good retirement after 20 years, 25 years, however long you want to stay in, you have good health insurance, and then you can go get a second job with the government and you'll get a second retirement by the time you're 60, and then you can live off both retirements and you're fine. I said, okay, that makes sense. So I'm just going to spend all of my money because I'm going to have retirement. What do I need to save money for? Like it just was never a thing. So, you know, I tell somebody again, broke that wireframe. So I want to challenge anybody listening, like think through what your parents did. Think through why you're doing the things that you're doing. You know, like, is it because there's a scarcity? Is it because that's what you always saw? Is it because, you know, I think I've told this story on the podcast before, but there was a thing with my wife told me, I can't remember if it was a Spanish thing or a whatever, it doesn't matter. But, you know, the daughter saw the mom cutting the ends of the ham off, putting it into the pan. And before, you know, on Christmas Day, cutting the ends of the ham off, put it into the oven. Why do you cut the ends of the ham off? Well, let me call grandma. Grandma's the one who taught me how to do this. This is what we do. Call grandma. Grandma says, well, I don't really know. We just cut the ends of the ham off, put it in there. Call great-grandma. Great-grandma says, oh, well, the ham was too big to fit in the pan. So that's just what we did. Okay, so now all of these years you've been cutting the ends of the ham off, even though you got a bigger pan and it all fits for no reason. So if we could figure out why we're doing the things we're doing, you know, even when we're raising our kids, like if I could figure out why, like there are times I cannot stand when my sons cry for no reason. And I know it's because I used to cry a ton for no reason. Like I was raised mostly by my mom. My dad worked his butt off all the time, so he wasn't around as much. So I would cry just because I was around the emotional side of my brain a lot more with my mom and my sisters. And now it drives me bonkers. And I'm like, I really need to control that back because there are times where my kids are going to cry and they need to cry. And I need them to be comfortable with that. So I need to get more comfortable with it. But man, oh man, it's tough work. Is there anything that you see in your life, the way you're raising your kids or the way that you're running your business, that you're like, no, I totally get that from my parents and I need to adjust that, or I totally get this from my parents and I need to drive towards it and keep doing it?
That's a good question. You know, my parents, they were so focused on like survival, and my mother's a very high anxiety person. So we were never taught emotional intelligence as kids. Yeah. And I think for a while I repressed a lot of what you just mentioned, like the emotional side of being a human, and learned to just kind of be like a problem solver. You know, don't cry about it and don't complain about it. Just do it. So now when my kids start crying, I jump into like fixer mode, like, oh, just do this.
Yeah.
Oh, just do that. Oh, you could have just done that, right? Like, instead of giving them a hug, you know, and waiting for them to finish crying and then teaching them the lesson, right? So I think if I were to do the second option, which is to let them cry, it would teach them a little bit more emotional intelligence, and they grow up to be more stable, mentally stable people. I think just I'm getting better at it because I'm obviously aware of the problem, and my younger son tends to be more empath. So like I can, he feels things more.
Yeah.
And I suspect that I probably as a kid was more like him, even though I don't identify as that. And just the kind of the high anxiety environment that I grew up in repressed that side of me. So I'm sort of like kind of reliving a childhood I never had with my younger son, and watching him grow up to be kind of like this emotionally intelligent person. But sometimes it's hard to like hold back that impulse of like, oh, you're crying because you just dropped that, like just pick it up, or, oh, you spilled that, just clean it, or, oh, you know. So, and that's an impulse that I have that, I'm getting better at it. And I did worse with my first son, and I'm doing better with my second son just because I, second chance.
Boy. You're like speaking to my soul on that one. Like I tend to do the same exact thing. It's like, you know, because there's part of me that wants to teach, like, you spilled your milk. We've got lots of milk. I can go buy more milk. We don't need the milk. This isn't a big deal.
Cares?
But at the same point, like we need to recognize like this is important to, you know, a 7-year-old or a 5-year-old or whatever. Like their milk is important to them. So I need to recognize that I could tell them, hey, I know this is important. I know that this is a thing, but, you know, I try to get to that. And I struggle with that all the time. And as we're, you know, trying to make that balance between not being worried about, like, just this morning, perfect example. My dog, puppy, 6 months old, went and chewed up my son's shoe. And he's 5, and that shoe meant a lot to him, right? It's got a little Iron Man thing on it. He's really excited. He loves his Iron Man, and now his shoe is gone. And it's like, it was like the end of the world for him, you know? And I was like, dude, it's a shoe. Like, we'll buy you another shoe. This is no big deal. And as you were saying that, I'm thinking to myself, boy, you could have really handled that a little better. Like, boy, I could totally see how that would hurt. Like, that's your shoe. That's your favorite shoe, you know? But instead, I just went to, let me just fix this. I'll just go buy a new one, you know? And I don't, boy, that's tough. That,
right, really, you didn't give him a chance to deal with the emotion, right?
Yeah.
Which is what was physically occurring at that moment. And there's a repression that would occur there the next time. Like, oh, my dad is just going to tell me to fix it. Let me just not cry.
Yeah.
But have you read the love languages, the 5 love languages for the kids one? There's one for kids.
No, I have not.
Oh, man. Read that one and then figure out what your kids' love languages are. So, like, my older son, his love language is quality time. So, like, he's an extrovert, like, and it sucks because my wife and I and my other son are all introverts. So, like, we don't want to be around people. So when my son, my older son, who's an extrovert, he wants to play games. Oh, can you play this with me? And you want to do this? Can we do that? And you're just like, no, I don't want to play chess now. Like, I'm tired.
I just want to sit on the couch.
you start to realize what it is that they identify with as like comforting. And for him, it's quality time. And for my younger son, it's physical touch and words of affirmation. So like the worst thing you could do to him is tell him, oh, you're bad or you're this. Like he'll really internalize that. Or like if you hit him or smack him or push him or whatever, that's the opposite of like physical touch. Is a big offense to him. So like when he's crying and stuff, you just gotta give him a hug. And it's like so simple, like with my other son, it's like you have to figure out more strategically, like, okay, how can we together figure out a solution to your problem and be more strategic. So when I read that book, it really taught me a lot about how to deal with my kids specifically the way they are. So
That's great. Have you read it for trying to figure out your wife as well, or mostly just focused on your kids at the moment?
Yeah, hers is words of affirmation, which I suck at because I don't need words of affirmation. I don't need anybody to compliment me on anything.
Yeah.
Mine is acts of service.
Yeah.
So it's funny. I realize that I tend to like respond to people with acts of service. So like when I spilled my milk and I'm crying, oh, I'll just clean it up, right? Like I created an act of service for you because that's my love language. But yeah. For him, he just needs the hug because his love language is the physical touch.
Yeah.
So like you tend to use your love language, the one that you need to serve others, even though it may not be the best way to serve them. And then sometimes I feel like I'm underserved a lot of times and I have a very high standard of like what I expect. Like I do everything for myself, right? So then yeah. I sort of deplete my love tank is what she says in the book. But it's interesting once you, there's dynamics there because my wife is words of affirmation. And but since I don't need words of affirmation, I tend to try to do acts of service to her when all she needs is a compliment. And I just don't think of it, right? Like my instinct is just to like do something for her.
Yeah.
So it's cool. It's a good, interesting book.
Yeah. I love it. Yeah. It's, I think that, so for me, the way I try to prioritize, and of course, nobody's perfect at anything, but so God, wife, and then kids. So really trying to make sure that my relationship with God is right so that I can flow that into my relationship with my wife. And anytime I get those things like out of balance, especially if I'm focusing too much on the kids, then the wife can really feel that. And I can see that she feels that, you know, and it turns into a problem, especially with her, with me working from home. So I'm around the kids all the time. And her working still, she's in the military still, so she's got another year left where she's out in the office, you know, 10, 12 hours a day before she finally makes it home. And it's like, boy, I really need to figure out a better way to serve her so that I can keep that relationship. Because the second that, you know, my kids are out, it's still my wife and I, we got to make sure that that is an extremely solid relationship.
I would challenge you, your wife, to reframe that. I would challenge you to reframe that hierarchy to self, God, wife, kids, because you're not serving yourself and you're not going to be able to serve God. You're not going to be able to serve your wife. You're not going to be able to serve your kids. If you're unwell and you're not serving yourself first and making sure that you are healthy, there's no way you can show up for anybody else. And if you don't have a healthy marriage, it's going to affect your kids, right?
Yeah.
So if you put your kids before your marriage, then your marriage is going to suffer and your kids are going to suffer. So I would actually challenge you to go self, God, wife, kids.
Right. You're the second person to tell me I need to adjust and put myself somewhere higher on it because I don't have myself anywhere on that list. And it's,
yeah,
I don't know if it comes from like the military side of the house where you just don't ever think about yourself at all. Like it's just what's the mission or where it comes from. I do a terrible job of taking care of myself. I don't know. I'll have to spend some time meditating on that and try to figure out what that means for me and what that means for, you know,
well, you think about it, they're going to learn from you, right? Like your kids are going to see that you don't take care of yourself and then they're just not going to take care of themselves when they're older. They're just going to copy everything that you do. Like if you wake up every morning and work out, they're going to see you working out every morning, then they're going to think that that's a normal thing. And then they'll be more likely to be healthy and exercise themselves. Whereas if they see you just drinking beer in the morning and, you know, watching TV, then that's what they're going to do. They're going to drink beer and watch TV. So, I mean, get your shit together first.
In the morning.
Exactly. Shots of DayQuil to do a podcast.
Shots of DayQuil, yes. Yeah, I put on my wife and I for the first time ever, like we've talked about our goals, but the first time though, for 2024, we sat down and wrote all of our goals out, what we actually want to achieve for the year as a family, as a couple. Part of that is workouts, even with the kids. Like we want to have intentional workouts with her. I mean, they're younger, 9 and 5 are the ones who are actually be working out. So, you know, maybe it's a couple bike rides around, you know, a couple loops around the neighborhood or whatever on the bike. Maybe it is doing some calisthenics in the garage or whatever. But, you know, intentional workouts with the kids, because we want to show them that that type of taking care of yourself is important. You know, I appreciate the challenge on that. I definitely need to readjust and think through that a little bit better so that I can take care of myself a little bit more.
It's a realization I came to fairly recently. I used to always let myself go and then just do everything for everybody else. But then if you're not healthy yourself, you're not going to be able to serve others at the fullest potential. So,
yeah, you're exactly right. And it's, you know, I've noticed it, you know, because you'll hit that wall every once in a while where you're just like, I'm done. I can't do anything anymore. I need to go sleep for 15 hours and, you know, and it's, you know, it's part of the process, I guess. But so what kind of questions do you have for me? What's next on your agenda with where you're at?
Listen, man, I just take it day by day. I'm actually really bad at like vision work and, oh, where do you see yourself in 5 years? I don't know. I just kind of go day by day, you know, I look for deals and come home and spend time with the kids. Yeah, I'm going to struggle with answering that question about what's next. And, I recently took up flying. Like, I'm learning how to fly planes.
Yes.
I never had, going back to the taking care of yourself, like, I never, like, for the past 10 years, I didn't have, like, a hobby or, like, an interest for myself. Like, I didn't have anything that was for myself, right? It was always work, kids, wife, you know. It was never like, oh, I'm going to go do something for myself for fun, right? I would never take trips by myself. I would never go out by myself. I don't do anything by myself. So I took up flying. It's pretty cool. I go like once or twice a week and I take lessons. I assume eventually I will be able to finish and get the private license. It's taking a little bit longer for me to, longer than I expected to get it done. It's surprisingly difficult to fly an airplane. but I think it would be cool once I become more proficient to buy a small plane, and then we can travel to places. We have a little place in the Bahamas on an island that is like really hard to get to, so you have to charter a plane or go on a boat. So if we had a plane of our own, we could just go like every weekend. It's a 1-hour flight. So that's sort of something that's on like the horizon for me, relatively new, which is pretty cool and exciting.
I love that. Let me see. Flying is plane fun. So I fly small planes.
Cool.
It's on my list to buy a plane. I was hoping for last year, just the way life went, and never got to it. So perhaps this year I'll buy a plane or jump into a partnership on a plane. Something like a 6-seater, like a Cherokee 6 or something like that. But what made you decide flying? Because, I mean, you piqued my interest, and I love flying.
Yeah, so we went to, we've had this place in the Bahamas, and man, it's a pain in the butt to get there. Like, and it's expensive. I have to charter a plane that fits 8 people. It cost me $6,000 round trip. And so then I have to, like, find 4 other people to split the plane with me and go, right? Like, I have a place in the Bahamas. I can barely go to it because it's so hard to get to it. And then my aunt and uncle, they also have a place in the same island, and they bought into this partnership, and I flew on their plane to go over there, and I paid them like their cost. I think it was like $700 round trip.
Yeah.
So much cheaper than chartering a plane. And I just got a taste of private, general aviation and how easy, like I always thought flying was like this out of reach thing where you have to go through TSA and you hate your life and delays and, bad service. And I literally walked up to a hangar on a private plane. The pilot was there. We put our bags in the plane and we took off. We got to the Bahamas. Yeah. It was like, whoa, like this exists. And it's not that out of reach. Like, I saw that my aunt and uncle did it and they bought into this partnership. It was relatively inexpensive and it's not that difficult. So that kind of planted the seed. And I was like, you know what? And then I talked about it for like a year, getting my pilot license. And finally, one of the guys in my GoPod was like, man, you've been talking about this for years. Just do it already. I finally did it.
Yeah. It took me probably 3 years to finally do it, to finally be done with it. Like, from the start of my training till I finally got my license.
To get the private?
To get my private. So we had a kid in the middle of that. I deployed to Africa in the middle of that, and we moved to Japan in the middle of that. So just everything just kept laying on and laying on and laying on. Excuse me. Which took forever, but man, was it worth it. And I barely fly. I mean, I've had my license for like 5 years and I barely fly, I should have like 600 hours by now and I've got like 140. But
how many hours did it take you to get the license, the private license? You remember?
I want to say I was somewhere around 60, 65, somewhere like that. I could look back at my logbook but it was, it took me time wise is where it took me a lot longer. So, thankfully, and I don't know one reason or another, but when I come back from like a hiatus of flying, like a deployment to Africa per se, like I come back and then I start flying, they're like, dude, you fly really well for not flying in a while. This is great. Like, we don't have to catch up a lot. So it worked out well for me I kept a lot of those skills for me. It was more like riding a bike. So that's a plus, but at the same point, it's like, golly, it still takes forever. And like the hours you still got to double up on a lot of hours and redoing things. But whenever you're ready for your check ride, let me know. The guy that I used here in Central Florida was awesome. And I could chat with you about that.
Cool.
So, yeah.
It was I'm like 45 hours in, so. and I feel like it's taken me so long to learn how to land the plane. Like, I think I've landed like 150 times already, and every time there's like something I overlook or some tiny variable that makes it difficult. It's like really, really difficult. I don't lie.
So the secret to a perfect landing is a perfect pattern.
Perfect approach. Right?
So if you get your pattern down right, where you're feeling really good, you're at the right airspeed when you cross the numbers, and you're already setting the things in, and you're making sure everything, like, that is where you're like,
you do all that, and then the air traffic controller tells you extend downwind, and you're like, so now you have to keep going. It ruined your whole plan. There's always something. There's always something that changes.
Well, here's one cool thing is you're flying at a place with ATC. So a lot of people, when they're learning, like, that's the hardest part. They finally have to go land at a place that has a tower, and they have no idea how to communicate because they've been flying in places that don't have towers at all.
Dude, I got that.
And they're like,
communication, I got that down.
So great. You know, it's, what kind of planes do you fly right now?
Cessna 172.
Yeah, that's about normal. Yeah. Thankfully, they're very forgiving. So that's a plus. Super forgiving planes.
I've had some interesting landings on those.
Yeah, yeah. Me too. Yeah. Like, time to add power. I just bounced off the ground. We're going to do a go-around. It's so much fun, though. And, you know, you've got a family of four. So that's, are you planning to have any more kids?
No.
We're done. So family of four is great because you can get like a Cessna 182. Nice. It's got a good amount of power. It's it's got a ridiculous amount of stuff that you could throw into it. It's got depending on the one you have, like 1,100, 1,200 pound useful load. So if you could fit 1,000 pounds of stuff inside there and fly over to the Bahamas, you are sold. Yeah. Like, that's cake. And a 182 is not that expensive.
Right. Yeah. I'm looking at the 206, which is a little bit more expensive because it has a turbo. So you can go a little bit higher. I'm crossing the ocean, so like, I want to be safer. And also, where we go in the Bahamas, we have to bring all of our own food because there's no grocery store on the island. There's no like supermarkets. It's like convenience stores. We bring everything. Useful loaded.
Yeah. Yeah.
I assume the kids will grow into 200 pound humans. So,
yeah, eventually that will happen. Yeah. Yeah. Darn right. Yeah. That's on my bucket list, is buy my own jet. But,
yeah.
The Cirrus are pretty nice too. If you look at one of the Cirrus, they're obviously more expensive.
Useful load is really low though. That's the killer.
Yeah. Semi, but I mean, burn low fuel. But it's one thing I like about the Cherokee 6. I've got a family of five plus an au pair, so I've got six people that I would need to fly around anyways. But the useful load could be like 1,500-1,600 pounds. So it's a pretty high useful load on the Piper PA-32s, but we'll see what happens. I can't wait to buy a plane. I'm looking forward to it, but that's awesome that you're in the same boat. I had a challenge with one of the guys that I had on the, I can't remember his name right now, looking at his face, but anyways, he's another GoBundance guy that I talked to on the podcast. We had a challenge on who was going to complete our IFR rating before the podcast. And neither one of us even completed the test. Like, we got out and we were both like, golly, we suck at doing things for ourselves. Like, it just was not great. But, you know, is what it is. But
I don't think I would even dare to take my family on a plane if I didn't have the IFR rating. I'm like really fearful.
Yeah, I can understand the feeling there. Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe by the time I get the private, I will feel differently. But as of now, it's like, I think I'm just going to go full IFR and then fly my family around.
Yeah. Which I don't necessarily blame you, especially once you have those skills, you know. Like, the other day, I was flying, I was getting my night currency, so I was doing some touch and goes, and some cloud cover was coming in, and we saw it coming in, but it was just, all I was doing was touch and goes, so I'm in the pattern. And then my last one, I taxi back, I sit there, I tell everybody that's coming. There's a guy that was flying from Lakeland. He was just going to do a touch and go over where I'm at as well. And I was like, all right, yeah. He asked what the weather was. And I was like, yeah, we got some clouds moving in pretty quickly. So, you know, depending on how long it takes you to get over here, it may be bad. And then I take off. And then all of a sudden, there's a cloud. Like, I'm in a cloud. And I was like, holy crap, this came out of nowhere. You couldn't see it on the ground. I didn't know it was there. I didn't know it had moved in that fast. And I was thinking to myself, boy, if this had happened, like with family in, with something going on, and I wasn't just in the pattern, I was at a place I don't know or whatever. Like, this could be really bad. Like, this, could be, you know, but I thankfully was in the pattern. I knew where I was. I knew where I needed to be. I've got enough IFR training to to, I just turned and I was like, well, I know that I'm doing something that is a no-go. Like, we can't do this. I turned around. There was somebody else getting ready to take off. And I was like, I would abort that takeoff. Like, be done. Don't even take off. Like, there's stuff that couldn't happen. And then the guy coming in from Lakeland was like, wow, that stuff did move in real fast. Like, he could see it coming in from where he was. And I was like, this is just... So, like, that feeling you're having of not wanting to do it without IFR, I don't blame you. Because that you could get yourself into, especially at night, apparently, at night. Yeah.
We live in Florida. Like, it's a tropical environment where the weather changes, like, on a whim. So.
Instantly, yeah. I mean, apparently, caught the wind just right coming out of the Gulf and just flew right over to the top of us. But yeah. Anyways, Carlos, it was awesome chatting with you. I really appreciate you jumping on. Thank you so very much for your time. If somebody wanted to reach out to you, get a hold of you, maybe they're in Miami and have properties that they want to get managed, or they just want to reach out to you one way or another, what's the best way for them to do that?
You can shoot me an email. It's carlos@roverapm.com. PM is in property management. On social media, you can find me. I'm on Twitter. But the Carlos Rovira. Yes, I had to put a V for my name. to get this username that I wanted. Same with Instagram, the Carlos Rovira. I check those periodically, so you could DM me and I'll probably respond. But yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah, reach out with anything you need. I'm here to help.
Well, we will have all of that in the show notes. But Carlos, I thank you so very much for jumping on. It was a pleasure chatting with you. Best of luck on the flying stuff. Let me know when it comes time to buying a plane. I'd love to chat about it, just to kind of see where you're at. And maybe we can meet up somewhere for our families to get together for a $100 hamburger somewhere.
$100 hamburgers, yeah.
Yeah. Thank you again, Carlos. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Please like, subscribe, reach out to Carlos if there's anything he can do to help you out. Thank you, everybody, again, and we will see you on the next show.
Thank you so much for listening to the Biz Dad Podcast. We hope you found some value in your time here with us, and we look forward to bringing you the next episode. If you've enjoyed today's show, please subscribe and share so you and your friends won't miss our upcoming episodes. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, Twitter, and Rumble, where we continue these discussions and share more valuable content. Be the dad you know you need to be and run your business in a way you're proud to share with your kids. Keep crushing it.